Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Artists Helping Artists. We are the number one art show on Blog Talk Radio. This is Leslie Seda in beautiful South Pasadena, California, and I have my, what month is this? March co-host. Lori G. Miller on the line. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm fine, except I cannot believe I didn't know a month it was.
Yeah, really.
It's kind of been one of those months.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm gearing up because I'm teaching a two-day workshop in Indianapolis through the Renaissance Fine Art Gallery in Carmel, I think is the right way you pronounce it. I would, of course, being from California, I'd say Carmel. And then my son's competing in the NCAA Swimming Championships, also in Indianapolis. And then I come home on Sunday night, and Monday morning I teach a three-day workshop here in Pasadena. So that's
wow.
Why I didn't know what month it is.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a good
on.
Excuse or not. How have you been, Lori?
I've been great. Just painting, and we have a big local art show that we're kicking off for this month. So just, you know, getting together with the committee and pulling that together. So just, you know, life is going along as usual.
That's wonderful. I want to mention a little bit about next week's show. I think we're going to do this show, right, Lori?
I got an email
from Annie Salmas, who is a very good friend of mine. She's an amazing artist. And she was actually having lunch or dinner with some plein air artists, and they were all talking about how difficult it is for them to talk to potential collectors in a lot of different settings. Maybe when they're plein air painting, maybe when they're doing a plein air show, or maybe they're having their own art show. And a lot of it was about, you know, how can you, as an artist, feel comfortable about getting someone to buy your art in a short conversation? And so Lori and I are going to do a show on that next week, and I think this is something that every artist out there probably wants to know. How do you sell yourself and sell your art and feel comfortable about it in a little three-minute conversation wherever you may be? So I'm excited. I think it'll be a great show.
Yeah, I think it'll be really useful for a lot of people because I think, you know, we all struggle with that. You know, some people are very self-conscious about talking about, you know, themselves and promoting their own art, so I think mm-hmm. it'll be a great topic.
And there's different approaches you may have if you're standing at your easel halfway through a painting, or if you're at your own art show, or if you're at a competition, or something. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And those kinds of ideas, I love it when you email them to me, because we are coming up on year number 4 on doing this show, which if you count the weeks, that means we've done like 150 shows.
Wow.
And it's hard to come up with topics, but. But today's show, I have to say, was an easy one because Carolyn Anderson is probably, and I was just telling her this on the phone, the most requested artist. I get emails, can you get Carolyn Anderson on the show? So she will attest to the fact that I'm a complete pest, and even though she's been very, very busy, I have been emailing her and asking her if she would be our guest today. So just to review her bio, Carolyn, of course, is a nationally recognized artist. She's an accomplished pastelist and oil painter. She was born and raised in the Chicago area and attended school at Illinois State University. She joined the VISTA program, which, if you're not familiar with it, VISTA stands for Volunteers in Service to America, in the early 70s and was assigned to work on an Indian reservation in Montana. She eventually returned to Montana and now lives in, and I don't know if I've got the pronunciation, Havre, but she'll probably correct me, a small community in north-central Montana near the Canadian border. She's a member of the Northwest Rendezvous, NWR, in the American Impressionist Society, and she participates in many of the nation's largest shows and has had her work featured in numerous publications, including Southwest Art, Art of the West, American Artist, and Big Sky Journal. She's won many, many, many awards, including the C.M. Russell Best of Show, several NWR Awards of Excellence, and the AIS Awards of Excellence, which is amazing. Carolyn teaches numerous painting workshops across the country, which we are going to talk about today. She's taught at the Frye Museum in Seattle, Walt Disney Imagineering, Scottsdale Artist School, and the Fetchin Artist School. Her work is in the collection of many well-known artists and also in the collection of the Montana Historical Society. Carolyn, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm sorry for being such a pest.
You were kind of, but that was the only way that we got together here. So
I know. I think you're in the. You were hopefully are not still in the middle of some deadlines, but
no, I just have to varnish paintings now. So
oh.
Easy job.
You're at that good point. That's wonderful. Well, I'd love just to start out and have you tell us about how long you've been an artist and when you started your art career and kind of how that all came about.
I have been doing artwork for as long as I can remember, probably, mm-hmm. After high school. Full-time professional artist since the late 80s. Before that, I pretty much built my career while I was working either full-time or part-time. So, I did artwork all the time I was working, and then I have to say when my son graduated from high school in the late 80s, then I quit my job, and that was it.
And started your real job.
Yeah.
Wow. So where did you actually study?
Well, that's a hard one because, I went to Illinois State University. I took art classes there. I took, art history classes. But I pretty much bailed on that whole thing. And so I have to say, push comes to shove, I'm pretty much self-taught.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, in reading one of the articles on your website, it said that your parents really just wanted you to get a practical degree so you could earn a decent living. So
exactly.
When you...
exactly. That's how I ended up at Illinois State because, of course, that was a school primarily for education. So I was kind of looking at being an art teacher, which, in fact, my sister is now. But I never followed through with that. That wasn't what I wanted to do. So, and at that time, I can't say that the art instruction was that good anyway. So
you say you're self-taught, Carolyn. So were you studying with other artists? Were you just kind of doing this on your own while you were working? We all want to know how you became to where you are now because you're unbelievable.
I beat my head against the wall a lot. We have so many advantages. I can't say I wasn't out there taking workshops. I didn't particularly have any kind of mentor around mm-hmm. here to steer me in a direction. But I also felt that at some point I really just needed to find my own way, mm-hmm. And so I think that's one of the reasons why, when I teach workshops now I can explain it fairly well because I'm not just repeating something somebody told me. I'm telling them something that I learned the hard way,
Right.
So it was just a matter of just working and doing more work and, trying to find my own place in the whole scheme of things.
Wow. Well, we like the place you found.
Well, thank you.
It's amazing. Now, I read something in one of those articles, too, about how living in Montana has had a big impact on your life and your art. Can you elaborate on this?
It's somewhat complicated in a way. I suppose the obvious one would be I probably came... west to Montana, away from my family because, they didn't really approve of what I was doing. So mm-hmm. it was a constant, gee, Carolyn, if you moved back to Chicago, you could get a really good job kind of thing. So, because I had to struggle for so many years financially
sure.
that, it was kind of difficult. And I don't think my parents appreciated that. So I think, that putting a little separation was a good thing. But mm-hmm. the most important thing, and it's a little more difficult to explain, is that when I look back on it, I think that the difference in, it may sound kind of strange to people, but the difference in spatial perception of where I am now as compared to where I grew up was so different that it really kind of led me in some different directions about explaining how we see and what we see and understanding a little bit better what I was looking at.
Okay.
That kind
can
of
you
stymied
give an,
you there, didn't it? Yeah.
Can you give an example?
Well, the easiest way, first of all, I think that we are oriented at an early age to understand the space around us.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at certain areas of the country, and for example, the Midwest is a good example there, you're dealing with primarily, in artist terms, foreground and middle ground.
Right.
The background is not really there for the most
mm-hmm.
part, When you come west, and especially to the western plains, you're dealing entirely with middle ground and background. There's no foreground, you know. It's not in the visual plane, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so it really changes up how you see, I think. You know, there's an element there. And so, yeah, that whole foreground, middle ground, or middle ground, background is probably the best description I could give you. So it's more of a matter of having to pay attention to different kinds of nuances within the surroundings.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Is that something that took a long time to kind of figure out, or did
To realize that it did have an impact on on my artwork. And it's interesting because I paint by and large close up things. I don't paint distance, for example.
Right.
You know, that isn't what I do. But understanding that concept has an impact on how I see the close up things.
Sure.
And
wow.
I'm just gonna go, okay, yeah, where's this going, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Carolyn, you have a very distinctive style, and I'm just wondering, you know, it's very energetic, it's very loose. Did you develop this style over time, or was this just sort of natural to you? And also, you know, it sounds like you didn't really study with anyone, but were there influences from other artists that maybe you saw in books or, you know, online?
Oh, of course. You know, I had to work at my style. And it came from a place where I knew what I didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And my very earliest work was a lot tighter. And, you know, I gradually kind of abstracted some more of the elements. You know, that was a process because it's not easy to do, you know, to kind of take the painting to a different place, if you will. So, you know, I had to work at it. I still have to work at it. It's still an issue. But, yeah, there were influences. You know, I can say, you know, my early years spent in the Art Institute looking at the Impressionist paintings had something to do with it. Fashion's work and his use of abstraction and the implied sense of form was important. When I discovered some more of the Russian Impressionists, that was another thing, because I liked the expressiveness in their brushstrokes. So it's a combination, you know. And I have to say that I'm probably one of the few realist painters out there who absolutely likes abstract work,
mm-hmm.
and especially some of the abstract expressionist work. So, you know, there was an element of that, too.
Now, do you have any tricks for staying loose? Because I know with every painting I start out saying, okay, I'm just going to, I really want to keep this loose and fresh. And
no one ever asked this question.
Yeah, and I just find myself getting tighter and tighter because I just feel like I haven't defined the form enough or whatever. But do you, you know, do you have any tips for
it? Well, there are some tricks. Obviously, how you stand at your easel is one of them. And if you're one of those people that sit, you need to have a chair that has wheels on it so you can vary your stance. The problem with standing in front of a painting and working on it for a long period of time is that our focal point becomes narrower and narrower.
Oh, good point.
And so the pieces on the painting start to lose their relationship to one another, and then we become caught up with painting the pieces as accurately as we think we should. So how you stand at your easel, maintaining, you know, if you find yourself leaning into the painting too much, you know, try and break the habit. I still do that. I still have issues with that. You know, I'll find myself just, you know, leaning in too closely. I say when you stand at your easel, you really, unless you're working on a huge painting, that presents different problems, but you really need to be able to see all four edges of the painting in your viewpoint. Because then you're seeing the whole. So you need
right.
to find that point at the easel where you're comfortable. Now, if it's a little bit larger painting, obviously this entails kind of a back and forth movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think of Sargent when he did those great big giant paintings and would dart back all the way across the room and then dart up and put a brushstroke on the canvas. So that's really important. So and that's just habits, either good habits or bad habits. So they're you know, there's something you can get a handle on. Like I say, there aren't very many physical things you can actually do to improve your painting, but that's one of them. The other one is to watch how you hold your brush. If you find yourself noodling with the brush, holding it like it's a pencil, you know, break the habit. There are times when we need to do that. I'm not saying that, you know, there aren't times when we do need to kind of choke up on the brush a little bit. But pay attention to how you're doing it. Don't just do it out of habit.
Hmm. Great.
So two things that are guaranteed to improve your painting.
What's it like teaching that loose style? Because that's what is so amazing about your paintings. I mean, it just, oh, boy, I could look at them forever. I mean, is that hard to do? I would think it would be really hard.
Well, yeah. The teaching end of it is kind of difficult because when you're, I have issues with do as I do kind of program, you know,
mm-hmm.
in other words, do it this way. I would rather teach my students how to see and go find their own way.
Right.
However, the problem with that is obviously I have to teach what I know, and what I know is what I do. So, you know, I use that as an example, but it's not an end-all, be-all. But I do try and get the students to, you know, like I said, back off on the painting, paint the relationships between what they're seeing and not the thing itself. So I try to, in essence, to kind of teach them a different way of looking at the what it is that they're trying to paint.
Mm-hmm.
And,
wow.
you know, hopefully they can take the information and make it their own.
So you obviously have defined your style, and it's something that I think every artist is trying to achieve to do. Can you offer any advice to our listeners about finding their signature style?
Well, I say the first thing you have to do is figure out what it is that you really like. I think as
mm-hmm.
artists we get caught up in all kinds of visual information, you know. So we'll see a painting and we'll go, oh, that's so beautiful, I just love it, you know. And then we'll look at another painting, it could be entirely different, and go, oh, that's so wonderful, I just love it, you know. So the first thing you have to do is narrow down what it is that you're really drawn to. And I did this many years ago, and I should just kind of revamp every once in a while. But I think it's helpful. So here's the game you want to play with yourself. Is set up several images. I mean, you can pick them out of books. You can do whatever, you know, it may be. Different kinds of things that you like. And say, okay, now if I could own one of these paintings, it would hang on my wall and I would look at it every day for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Which one would it be? And that really quickly starts to narrow it down. You know, there's a difference between liking something and wanting to live with something.
Right.
Forever, you know.
Yeah.
So that starts to narrow it down. And once you start to narrow it down, then you should start to be able to grasp what it is that appeals to you. You know, not just, let's say, the subject matter, not the obvious thing, but the visual elements. And that could be something like contrast. It could be subtlety, it could be color, it could, you know, there's all kinds of variations here that you can throw out that would say visually attract you.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can narrow that down, at least that gives you a bit of a direction.
Hmm. So along
so you don't
those,
get, go ahead.
I'm sorry, along those same lines, you know, what kinds of things inspire you, you know, when you're thinking of your next subject to paint?
A lot of times I paint things by default, I have to say that. But what I try to look for can vary, but ideally I like to set, and I would say my better paintings have something there, I like to set some kind of problem-solving goal, if you will. So, for example, it could be, you know, I'm going to concentrate on values or a value pattern or an abstract value pattern. I'm going to see how many edges I can lose, for example, you know. So those are the kind of problems that I'll set up for myself. So
now
I take it outside of the element of what the painting is and take it into visual information parameters.
So when you're determining the subject of your next painting, are you sometimes thinking more about how you're going to paint it and the problem you're going to solve versus what the actual painting is?
Kind of.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
Well, it takes it to a different place. So you don't get so caught up in the subject.
Right.
The subject will always be there. You know,
uh-huh.
as realist painters, we're, you know, the subject is going to be there. We aren't doing abstractions.
Right.
You know, the abstractions would tend more towards feeling, but I believe you can combine those two,
mm-hmm.
and so it's going to come out. But that allows you to play with that visual information a little bit more. See, it opens doors.
Mm-hmm.
What you want to do is open all the doors you can when you're faced with the painting,
hmm.
and then you want to be able to control. You know, where am I going here? Am I going for pattern? Am I going for color harmony? Am I, you know? And so you narrow that down that way a little bit. But you always want to leave it open. You never know what's going to happen. I think painting is a process. I don't look at it as an end product. I'm not really good at finishing paintings a lot of the time. You know, I'm kind of always looking for the Holy Grail. I don't know. I just, you know.
You're a good starter.
Yeah, the starts can be good, but sometimes it's hard to find a way into the... When a painting becomes predictable to me, you know, when it looks predictable, it's kind of like, yeah, been there, done that, I can
mm-hmm.
see where this is going, I lose interest. There has to be some kind of challenge there somewhere. Hmm. So sometimes you have to go out and you have to find the challenge.
Sure.
So what I'll do sometimes is just, you know, when you paint every day, you know, it's not like I'm getting models in here every day. So a lot of times what I'll do is just grab stuff, and it can be photos that are not particularly appealing, but I'm going to say to myself, you know, is there any way I can find my way into this and find some information that's interesting?
Hmm. Okay. Carolyn, do you have like a standard approach that you use when you're starting a painting? So you found a subject that you want to paint. So do you have kind of a step-by-step process that you go through? And if so, can you tell us, kind of take us through what that process would be? Or is it just different every time?
I never particularly draw anything out, unless it's a little bit larger canvas, and then of course that requires a little more planning. You know, I'm kind of a little bit more I paint by the seat of my pants, so to speak. So yeah, I pretty much almost always start a painting with what I say dry paint. You know, not getting it runny,
mm-hmm.
Getting wet, sloppy areas all over the painting, because once you do that, you can't control edges and things just get out of hand. So I do draw, I guess, but I draw with a paintbrush, and I usually use a mixture of gold ochre and mineral violet, which gives me something which is a little bit neutral.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to compromise anything that's coming over the top of it. And I can also, by using those two colors, the gold ochre is kind of similar to raw sienna. By using those two colors, I can get my neutral, but I can also cool it or warm it just a little bit, depending on, you know, when I get to that point. So, you know, I try to keep my strokes minimal at best to begin, because getting information down on the canvas that's misleading can be really harmful. So I try to control that end of it. But I always say, you know, get it in the ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to draw things or paint, you know, the draw, paint, start. It's not going to be exact, let's put it that way. You know, because you can refine painting. You know, we tend to forget. Painting is an additive process. And as we add paint, we have a tendency to obviously change all kinds of things. And they could be shapes. They could be contours. They can be all kinds of things, and sometimes it's not always good. So you get those marks in there that are confusing. It would be like if you sat down to write a little story or something like that, and you just covered the paper with a whole bunch of words that didn't make any sense. It'd be kind of tough to go over the top of that and write something that you could actually read.
Right. Of course. Are there certain subjects that are harder for you to paint than others?
Kids.
Oh,
children.
Really?
Yeah. You know, that's why I do them all the time, because they are difficult, because the shapes on children are fairly rounded, and the value changes are really subtle. So, yeah, that's difficult, you know. Obviously, maybe things that I don't paint would be like distance scenes. I don't do that,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I suppose I could say that would be difficult because I don't do it. But, I mean, for what I do, children would be the most difficult.
Now, can you tell us a bit about your studio and how it's laid out? And
my studio is in the middle of my house.
Why?
Kind of designed with that in mind. But I have to say, and I want, and for all those artists out there who are working without studios, I want to say I built my whole career working out of my living room.
Wow.
So, you know, doing good framing on the kitchen counter, you know, it wasn't until 2000 where I actually had a separate studio. So, but anyway, with that in mind, my studio is in the middle of the house. It's across from the main entry of the house, which is all glass doors and glass windows looking out on the mountains.
Oh,
and
wow.
Then the main entry, I have bookshelves on either side with some of my art books. And then my studio is right there with French doors. So that's the space, you know, where I go to paint. So, yeah.
And did I read
it's
in the middle of your house because you have to stay away from the cold?
Stay away from the cold. Actually, it is one of the warmer rooms of the house because the house has a lot of windows in it. So, yeah. So then, you know, the whole living space is on one end, and then, you know, bedroom space and laundry stuff is on the other end. And, yeah, I like it. Of course, you know, I've always worked where I lived. I never had a studio outside of my home. So, you know, I find it appealing. I can wander in my studio into the studio in the morning in my pajamas with a cup of coffee and nobody's going to know. So,
did you specifically design your house and build it with the studio in mind, or was it a house that it was already existing that you?
No, it was designed with the studio in mind. I knew what I wanted, you know. So, and I wanted the north windows, so the studio, the windows. You know, there's windows on the north side, but I also wanted to be able to look out to the front of the house without getting all that southern light, so that's where the entryway is.
Okay.
Yeah. And then it goes out, those front doors go out on a deck, which is basically over what I call my sunken yard, because if you can wrap your brain around this one, I'm kind of on the prairie here, by a river and a lake, but on the prairie. And so the downstairs yard, so I have a walkout downstairs, but it's dug out.
Hmm.
Think the first Star Wars film, I don't know if you ever remember that, but the first Star Wars film, and they come up to this house and it's got this huge dugout area around the house, like a big hole in the ground. Yeah, well, that's kind of what this is. And so the deck is suspended over that.
Oh,
but
wow.
Then you walk out on ground on the other end of it. Yeah.
Right.
So,
okay.
Different.
And do you have any favorite paints or brushes or tools, anything about your studio that stands out?
I've used Holbein paints for years, you know, and part of it is because I like the consistency of the paint, and I like the fact that the paints are evenly creamy, I guess, if you will. So I don't need to use much medium, if any, you know. So that's, you know. And then sometimes, you know, you just get into habits. So I use, you know, certain things because I've just been using them for years. I think one of the, probably what some people find more interesting about my studio is I do not have things all over the walls. I do have a few things just because, you know, sooner or later you start getting tired of stacking everything on the floor because you have to, you know, move it to vacuum. But what I do have is a ledge, like a small shelf that sits right at the top of the baseboard on one of the long walls.
Mm-hmm.
And that shelf is where I put wet paintings or old paintings or paintings I don't know what to do with or whatever, which allows me to look at them if I want to, but they aren't right up there in my visual plane, you know, when I walk into the studio. You know, you don't just automatically look down. So you have to go out of your way to do that. So I like that because I don't like the visual clutter having things that I'm maybe not happy with or, you know, whatever. I don't want to look at them.
Yeah, we talked a lot about that visual clutter in a show we did 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I think it personally, it impedes me.
Absolutely.
I don't like visual clutter.
Yeah.
So I keep all that stuff, like I said, right down about baseboard level on a little shelf, and it works great.
Mm-hmm. Good for you. Now, I know you're a self-taught artist, but has there been a great piece of advice you've received in your art career that you could share?
I can think of probably the one thing that has had the most impact on me was something that I read in a book a long, long, long time ago. And the book was Peter London, No More Secondhand Art. And the quote was, if what I paint does not surprise me, how can I expect it to be a revelation to anyone else?
Oh, I got to write that down.
So that's probably been, you know, my little guiding rule all these years. If what I paint does not surprise me, how can I expect it to be a revelation to anyone else?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Carolyn, do you accept commissions at this point in your career?
No.
Have you ever?
A long time ago. And in fact, you know, I started out with pastels, you know, eons ago when a friend of mine who painted said, you know, we can do these. He worked at a factory. He said, we can do these portrait commissions of the people at the factory for $20 and make some quick cash. I did that for a little while, actually. But you know, no, I haven't done any commissions in a long time. I don't take commissions. I have issues with them. And the main thing, I think, what a lot of people don't realize is it's a different kind of work, and my hat's off to those people who do it and do it well.
Oh, boy, is that true.
Yeah, because what you're doing is painting to someone else's expectations
right.
and not your own.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So that's a difficult path to follow.
Very true. Good for you. So how do you title your paintings?
Not very well. I use, unfortunately, I use the same titles over and over again a lot of the time.
For example,
heaven only knows how many paintings are out there that are titled Rocky Boy Dancer, for example, or, you know, Mother and Child or whatever. Every once in a while, and I could probably count the number of paintings on one hand where I've actually come up with an inspired title for a painting. I usually go with something somewhat descriptive.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean, you know, like Mother and Child. Well, you know, I'm not good at titling paintings. And I recognize that sometimes a good title can make the difference in a sale.
You know, it's funny you say that because I was at an art show 2 weeks ago and I talked to two different people who were telling me about their art collections, and they both brought up a painting that had a really clever, kind of cool title. And it really struck me, and I thought, ooh, I need to be more creative in my titles. I couldn't believe
it. It can have an impact on a sale. It really can.
Kind of surprising, but you would
think
it would be.
You know, and like doing people, and I shy away from it, even though sometimes I do. I mean, sometimes I'll title the painting by the name of the person, you know,
mm-hmm.
but not all the time, and certainly probably I'm less likely to do it. I'd rather it be a little more universal, you know.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
So, yeah, titles are kind of they're a strange thing. Like I said, I'm not very good at it. One of my worst moments ever probably came many years ago at an art show, and these people bought a painting of mine that was actually of my neighbor's horse, a beautiful white horse, and they bought it. They said they were going to buy it for their daughter's room, you know. Oh, that's nice. And so they turned to me and they said, "But the painting title at the time was probably something like White Horse, you know. But they turned to me and asked me what the horse's name was. And I'm not a very good liar, and I wasn't thinking very quickly on my feet, and I told them exactly what the horse's name was, which was Satan.
In hindsight, you're thinking, maybe I shouldn't have.
Yeah.
Now, they'd already bought
an
paint for the painting, which is probably a good thing. But, you know, if I had told them that before they bought the painting, they might not have bought it.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Oh,
for their daughter's room.
And the interesting thing was my neighbor had actually named the horse that because it was going by this old superstition that if you gave your horse a horrible name, that it would be a good, I don't know, it's something weird. And she actually called the horse Sadie. You know, as a nickname.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why I didn't even think to say that. No, I just pop out with Satan, and I thought, oh, yeah, that's great.
Well, they already bought it.
They just bought a painting for their daughter's room.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, that's pretty funny. Carolyn, your workshops are really popular. Can you describe what someone should expect if they want to take one of your workshops?
We primarily work from models, during the workshop in pretty much what I call just a straight-on kind of head and shoulders. I mean, sometimes people will do more figure, but I don't necessarily teach, you know, hey, we're going to paint the figure today and, you know, and give elaborate poses or elaborate costumes. And there are reasons for it. Number one, I feel it's a controlled subject with controlled lighting, you know, a fixed subject with controlled lighting. And getting a handle on painting the face, you know, if you can do that, you can take it just about anywhere. Because what you have are all the elements of any kind of painting. I mean, we're talking values and color and, you know, drawing and all those kinds of things. But then you also have the issue of how we see the face. And we don't exactly see things as accurately as we think we do. So if you can learn to actually make good comparisons on, let's say, a head, you know, on looking at a person, then you can take that information and use it elsewhere. So that's pretty much what I do in the workshops. As far what I try to teach, however, is, you know, explaining how we see some of the pitfalls of what we see and trying to get them to move outside their comfort zone a little bit. So I try to create a little bit of an atmosphere. Like I say, everybody should kind of have a sense of what their comfort zone is when it comes mm-hmm. to painting. So what you want to do is just step outside of that slightly. Hmm. Not so you fall off the cliff, because we know what's going to happen then. But number one, the chances of doing a really great painting in a workshop are kind of slim. Unless you're just following somebody else's procedure. So if you want to explore your own boundaries, you have to accept that what you're going to paint is probably not going to work anyway. And if you try too hard, it's definitely not going to work. So why not just kind of put yourself in a little bit different place and try something different?
Right. So important. That is such an important message to know when you take a workshop. Now, you're in various locations this year. Where are you teaching?
Well, next week I'll be in Scottsdale.
Right.
And the following month I'll be in New Harmony, Indiana. So that a good time will be had by all. I think C.W. Mundy's going to be there and Laura Robb's going to be there.
We had C.W. on the show earlier, I guess last year, and he was hysterical.
He is. He's kind of a kick. Yeah. Last year we were both teaching at the same time in New Harmony, and C.W., you know, I teach workshops that are pretty much timed by the model. So, you know, if the model's set to leave at 4 o'clock, the model's gone, and generally class is over. C.W., on the other hand, you know, he's out in the landscape, and I went to find him because I think it was almost 6 o'clock, and I still hadn't seen any sign of him, and I found him out in some poppy or a peony field or something like that with his students, and they're all clustered around him while he's carrying on. And as I walk up, some of the students are mouthing, "Help us."
We're hungry. We're cold.
So, but anyway, so Indiana, and let's see, Fredericksburg, Texas, and I'll do a workshop in Jackson, Wyoming in June, and then in the fall I'll go to Easton, Maryland. And all that information is on my web, or the contact information for it is on my website at carolynanderson.com.
Sign up, go to carolynanderson.com, right?
Well, you don't sign up there, but you can get the information you need, because I don't handle any of that sign up stuff.
Very nice. Wonderful.
It's just like a job. I just show up and do my thing. So somebody
what
else
you're
has to worry about all the specifics.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon?
I said, no, that's great.
Yeah.
Doing what you do best. Very smart.
Now, Carolyn, on your website, there's an article that you wrote about judging art. And can you share some of your thoughts on this with our listeners? I thought it was really interesting.
Well, let's see if I can kind of paraphrase. I have issues with, I guess what I've run into over the years are people perhaps that I've run into in classes that have been very disappointed because perhaps they didn't get into a show, you know, that was a jury show, or maybe they didn't get any kind of an award when they thought they should have. And I think we need to recognize that judging artwork, number one, can be very difficult. But the big elephant in the room there is that whoever is judging the show brings their own personal biases to the table. So even though you have certain elements you can judge paintings on, you can narrow, let's say, the better paintings down to, you know, quite a few. When it comes to actually picking supposedly the best, it's kind of a false premise because there are probably several paintings in those upper categories that could all qualify for, let's say, a top award. It's just that whoever's judging it likes certain things. You know?
So true.
And so the judging's always, you know, like I said, that's the elephant in the room. Nobody ever talks about that, but it's very true. So I like to tell people, you know, don't take this stuff too seriously. Now, as someone who, you know, I mean, I've won awards, and I recognize how important that is to us. And if nothing else, it, you know, it gives you a resume. You know, and artists seem to think we all need resumes of some kind, you know. But then the other thing is that we set up the whole idea that there's some kind of right or wrong or better or worse in this whole equation. And that's not necessarily true. Some things are, let's say, better put together, you know. They work better.
Mm-hmm.
Composition is better, perhaps, color harmony, you know, things like that. So there are those elements, but, you know, once we start narrowing down what we think is acceptable, then it kind of closes all sorts of doors. And within the premise of painting realism or painting something that we perceive to be real, then all of a sudden things start becoming real predictable. Because we've narrowed those parameters down so far, and I don't think people are as willing to take risks with what they're doing or what they're submitting. And so I think we've all been there where we go to shows and we look at the work and we go, you know, it's very nicely done, but it's kind of boring.
Mm.
And I think we need to put a little bit of that excitement back in there. So we need to accept that what we paint, even in, you know, realism, it can never be real. It's a painting. It's the illusion of three dimensions on a two-dimensional surface. So throw out that whole real idea and instead go for interpreting what it is that's important to you and how you see it. And the other thing is that we tend to put too much emphasis on craft. And I don't believe that craft alone makes a great painting. There has to be something else in the equation. And so when we start looking at something and just going, wow, isn't that nicely painting? Well, so, you know, where is the other part of the art? Where is the poetry in the art?
Right. Like sometimes you look at a painting and go, well, why didn't they just take a photograph?
Well, basically. Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can take ultra realism to another place, you know, by emphasizing different things or how you use your color or something like that. But when it's just a copy, you know, what's the point of it? So it's well done, and this person is a very good craftsman. But
right.
Art isn't just about craft. So it's part of it, but it's not the whole equation.
Hmm. I love what you said about the art judging, though, because it's so often. I mean, I talk to artists all the time who are so disappointed and discouraged.
I know.
They didn't get into a show. They didn't win a prize. And I keep saying to them, the judging was based on what that particular artist liked, and that's how
mm-hmm.
it works.
That's
it's not
exactly
a statement for the whole world.
Yeah. A lot of times if I happen to look at something where, you know, like some sort of show that someone has judged, I'm looking at it more just from the standpoint of, well, what did this person pick out that they liked?
Right.
That's what I find more interesting.
And that's you know? Really what it is.
Yeah. Because
so
you can, like I said, I've judged enough shows. You can narrow it down to, you know, usually quite a few paintings at the top end.
Right.
That all have good elements, you know, that, you know, the painting was well done, it was well composed, whatever, you know, wherever you want to go with it. So once you narrow it down to that, then what you end up picking is really going to be personal,
mm-hmm.
you know? What kind of mood are you in that day? What
yeah.
are you looking at that grabs you? And a lot of times what you'll see, which I find interesting, is that artists will pick things that they don't necessarily do. You've got two options here. They'll pick things that are pretty much just like what they do, or they'll pick the exact opposite. And it usually doesn't fall anywhere in the middle. So that, to me, is the most interesting thing. What did this person pick, you know?
And why? And try to figure out why.
Because there's no right or wrong here. I don't, you know.
Of course not.
And even in the better, worse range, you know, like I say, some paintings work better than other paintings. That's all there is to it.
Very true. So, Carolyn, when you get in a slump, what do you do to get out of it?
I just keep painting. Seriously, I don't know. Sometimes I think maybe it is a good idea just to take a break and just to walk away, you know, for a week,
mm-hmm.
and then come back. I just keep painting. And, you know, what happens is I end up with stacks of paintings that I end up throwing away. But, you know, I always feel, like I said, it's a process. You know, something's got to come out of it. So what happens is it's that whole craft and creativity issue again, because sometimes as your craft perhaps improves, then you're sacrificing some of your creativity. Can be one way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
Or perhaps you're being really creative and your craft just isn't there to you know, express what it is that you want to say or see or whatever it is. So you've got that issue. And then you always have the how we see changes, whether people believe it or not. And so that changes up. So you've got these variables going on there. And usually when you hit a slump, it's because you're working through some issues that you probably aren't even aware that you're working through, but you just need to take it someplace else. So I just generally just keep painting and start paintings and wipe them off or start paintings and stack them up and then throw them away, whatever, you know, just something to work through it.
Hmm.
It can help sometimes to change your palette up, you know, change the canvas, change something, you know.
Great advice.
Try a different subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Try
what I call the few still lifes that I do, I usually call, you know, something like a boring day in the studio. they don't do still lifes very often, but sometimes, you know, you just have to change things up a little bit.
Now, Carolyn, sometimes when I'm painting, I struggle with seeing values correctly, especially if I'm painting plein air. Maybe it's really bright outside.
Yeah.
Do you have any kind of tricks for that or tips on seeing values more clearly?
The biggest thing, especially in plein air, like you mentioned, is the brightness, you know. And the problem is our the physical part of it, obviously, our eyes dilate, you know. I mean, so our eyes close down or open up. I mean, that affects how you see, believe it or not.
Right.
The big thing with values is there are a lot of big things with values. But what you need to remember is that it's always as compared to. A value is never, does not exist on its own, you know, unless you compare it to something else. So, and you're kind of going, what? Well,
no, it totally makes
sense. That's
no,
how
I
we see.
Yep.
So everything has to be as compared to. So, you know, the good premise there is that you kind of get a grasp on something that's obvious and then work to your not so obvious, but you go with the obvious. And basically, we are primarily going to see contrast before anything else. I mean, that's kind of how our brain is wired, just that obvious contrast. So you look for that, so you're ascertaining your darkest values and your lightest values. And then all that stuff that falls in between, you have to compare to. It's not an absolute. It's never an absolute value. And then as you need to be open to the idea that as you put information on your canvas then becomes something else, okay? Your canvas is not what it is that you're seeing at some point. You're referencing what you're seeing, but your canvas isn't that. So the relationships on your canvas then start to take on more importance. At some point, the relationships of everything you're seeing are, you know, the most important. And then, you know, you move to this place where the relationships on your canvas become more important. You need to pay attention to that. So it's always as compared to. And when you're having trouble ascertaining a value, you want to go perhaps look to, and you want to do this both on not only what you're seeing, but on your canvas. Look to your darkest value, then look to your lightest value. and then do the same on your painting, and then go back to the relationship. Sounds like a lot of work, but it's not really, because we look at things so quickly. It's not a it's not a chore. And then also remember that I think ultimately the value scale, perhaps per se, that, you know, I mean, all of us as artists are familiar with. Like I say, I don't care if it goes from, if it's 9 steps or 10 steps, I really don't care what it is, or 6 steps, you know. But anyway, the value scale, black to white, can be a little misleading, because these are huge steps in the value range. And most of the information you're looking at is not a step. It would be like a 30-second note, or a, you know, a quarter note would be a big change in a value.
Right.
Or even sometimes, especially in doing people, and like I said, why kids can be so difficult, it's like a 64th note.
Wow.
And it's just minor. And then sometimes what you'll be seeing is really the same value. It's just that the color changes. And because the color changes, it gives us a perception, a different perception. So the best thing, though, as compared to, do not assume, and it's the same thing with color. We process the information based on as compared to. And so once we start taking information out of context, we lose that relationship of what is this value as compared to this value. But always go back to your big information. It's the same thing with color as it is with values. So with values, you would go to your extremes, your lightest light, your darkest dark. With color, here again, go with your extremes. If you have something that perhaps is appearing somewhat red, you know, that's an extreme, versus something that's kind of maybe more blue, you know. And that's also a good way to look for color and shadows, that as compared to. You have to look first for something that's more obvious, and then compare the shadow to that, and then you should be able to see it more easily.
Great, thank you.
Wonderful. So, Carolyn, I'd love to know what a typical day is like for you. And I know, I think it starts with jammies and coffee in your studio.
Yeah, pretty much. I usually go into the studio, you know, first thing every morning. So, yeah. And, you know, if it's a good day, I stay in the studio. If it's not a good day, I leave, go do something else. So,
do you paint all day?
Sometimes. But, you know, most of the time I'm good from, you know, like, you know, 8:30 till noon for sure, you know. And then sometimes I'll take a break, and sometimes I'll go back in the studio. It just depends on how things are going, you know. So, yeah, that's kind of it.
And you paint almost every day? Every day?
Just about.
Good for you.
In the summer, I don't paint on the weekends much. I go fishing instead. So,
I want to come to Montana.
You can come visit. I'll take you fishing.
I'd love to fish.
Yeah, the water is going to be not so hard here pretty soon, so it's melting now, the lake. So.
Not so hard. I love that.
Yeah, yeah, hard water. Hard water is kind of tough to fish on unless you're a nice fisherman.
Carolyn, what advice do you have for somebody who might be just starting their art career?
Paint a lot. You know, people wonder how to get, you know, to find your own style, to get better. You just have to do it. You know, that's all there is to it. And if you have a hard time doing that, set yourself up to just do time things. Small, you know, I see small studies are always good. And set a time frame on. You know, I'm going to do this in an hour. You know, just crank them out. And you know, you do a bunch of that stuff, it'll go somewhere. The other thing you have to recognize, that probably one of the more important things and one of the things that's so difficult for people, is you have to get some kind of exposure. Just, you know, keeping the work in your house for your family and friends is probably not going to do it. So, you know.
Yeah, your art doesn't sell that well when it just sits in your house. It's the weirdest thing.
Yeah, that is true. You can give it away sometimes, but, you know. Sometimes that's even hard. No. So exposure. And there you just have to, depending on where you're at, you have to go with whatever is available in your area. So if it's your local art show, you know, make sure you get out there, because you never know where a connection or a contact or a buyer is going to come from. You know, and it
true.
Could be, you could be at some small local show, or maybe you're hanging in the local bank, you know. I mean, I've done that, you know, and you just take whatever opportunity you can to get the stuff out there, because you never know when someone's going to walk in and say, you know, I own a gallery in wherever, and I'd sure be interested in handling your work. Or someone's going to walk in and say, you know, I'd like to buy something, and they, you know, who knows? You just never know. So exposure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I say throw it up and see what sticks on the wall, because you
got to
try everything.
Exactly. Most of us can't afford to advertise all the time. You know,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, that's a good way to do it, believe it or not. If you can afford it, just advertise. That can make a huge difference in people's careers, good or bad artists, both.
Right, right.
But most of us can't do that, so you just have to take whatever you can find wherever. And if you're into submitting work to shows, just do it. Don't get discouraged. Just keep
mm-hmm.
doing it.
Is there anything, Carolyn, you do differently as you look back over your career?
And I try not to worry about it. I have enough trouble figuring out what I'm going to do tomorrow without looking back.
Good.
And, you know, I have to say, in the big scheme of things, if I would say, you know, the things that I have not done well, I'm not a good business person. And, you know, this is a strange business, because on the one hand, we're trying to be these creative types that want to do what we want to do. But on the other hand, we have to recognize that what we're putting out there is a product.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I'm not really good at that whole product end of it. Some artists are pretty good at running it like a business and still kind of maintaining, you know, a sense of being true to who they are.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never been good at that, I have to say.
Hmm.
So I don't know. Would I change it? I don't know. You know, it's just, it is what it is, you know.
Well, I would say this next question then probably isn't going to mean much to you, but where do you see yourself head in the next 5 years or so?
I have no idea. I really
you just
don't.
Take it at one day at a time.
Pretty much, you know. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, let me
I
ask
would like
you.
To put together a book. I would like to do that at some point, and maybe write a few more articles I can just put somewhere, because I do think I have. You know, I've learned a lot of information over the years, and I need to share it with more people than just my workshop students. So,
yeah. Now, we talked about exposure a few minutes ago. The way you became well-known, was it through entering competitions, or how did that progress in your career?
Boy, you know, I think it was a combination of having some decent gallery contacts early on, but basically it was probably taking my work to shows where it would be viewed by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably it. And, yeah, going to shows.
Great.
Great advice. So to wrap up our interview, we have these questions that we like to ask all the artists. So you and Scott Christian and Kevin McPherson and Sherry McGraw will all answer the same questions.
Okay.
So first is, what's your favorite art book?
That's kind of a difficult one. I'll try and make it brief. It's kind of tough. I'm going to say I do like William Reese wrote a great book called The Painter's Process, and I do like that because it's one of the few art books that talks about the poetry in painting.
Mm-hmm.
So the text is good in the book.
So it's William Reese, The Painter's Process.
Yeah, and I do appreciate that book. I have lots of art books, obviously, that, you know, I call them picture books. You know, they could be in a foreign language. I can't read them. I just look at the pictures. but, yeah, that's one. You know, on my bookshelves, if I look at the books that probably have the most bookmarks in them, and I know this sounds kind of, but, and I call them art books. They really aren't. But Rudolf Arnheim's Art and Visual Perception and Visual Thinking are probably two of my favorites over the years.
Got it.
Okay. What is your favorite paint color?
Ironically, probably either cobalt or cerulean, and I say ironically because neither one of those colors is regularly on my palette.
Hmm. Ooh, that's very interesting.
I'll put them on the palette once in a while, but I don't usually have those blues on my palette. But
do you listen?
I like them.
Yeah. Do you listen to music while you paint? And if so?
Generally, Sirius radio.
Oh, okay.
And I usually put it on the loft and it just goes. I don't have to worry about changing.
Uh huh. Hmm.
Whose art do you wish you could add to your collection?
Walt Gonski.
Walt Gonski. And can you share a great studio tip for our listeners?
Mm-hmm. Rubbing alcohol or isopropyl alcohol. You know, you buy it in the pharmacy.
Uh huh.
It's cheap. I keep it in a spray bottle in my studio. It's the best thing ever for cleaning off my palette, cleaning paint off my telephone, cleaning paint off my garbage can.
Your light switch.
I clean my computer off with it, you know? Well, not
wow.
the screen, but, you know.
That's great.
So, yeah.
And
yeah,
cheap. You like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cheap.
Yeah, great tip. What's on your easel right now?
Just a small head study that might or might not live to see tomorrow's light.
Ouch.
Sounds kind of mean.
I know. You know, some paintings just weren't meant to exist for very long, you know?
Uh-oh.
Isn't that true? I scraped one yesterday.
I think more people need to take a little bit of that attitude. I take it too far. But you know, if you want to learn drawing, what do? You draw.
Mm-hmm.
And you usually draw on some kind of surface that, you know, like newsprint or something like that. And you do lots of drawings. So if you want to learn how to paint, what do? You just paint.
Yeah.
Well,
just,
I've always said, you go to practice. What profession is it that every time you practice, you think you have to have a finished
exactly.
masterpiece?
Exactly.
I mean, that's and you got to
exactly
stop and realize that, you know, if you have three duds a week, that's fine because
mm-hmm.
you're learning.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But they don't all have to go up and hang.
No, all paintings are not created equally.
Very good point. Very good point. Okay, so last question is there an artist out there you'd like to take a workshop with?
Yeah, here again, probably Walt Gonski, but he doesn't teach workshops, so. Yeah, I've always liked Walt's work.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Carolyn, for being on the show. And I'm sorry I was so persistent.
No, that's fine. This was fun.
But there's 15,000 artists out there that will be very happy that get to listen to this interview.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. And hopefully one of these days our paths will cross and we can say hello and it would be wonderful. So take care and have a great week and good luck
okay.
to the head on your canvas.
Okay, thanks.
Thank
bye.
You. Thanks, Lori.
All right, thank you. Take
bye.
Care. Bye-bye.